essentially left alone to set my own priorities. While I disliked artificiality of any kind, I gradually learned to put on a public face for the camera and for the crowd. My husband often explained the importance of body language. If you smile, you give people confidence. If you don't, they will suspect something is wrong and feel uncertain or worried. I could not question his reasoning. He had, after all, held his country together through various crises by going out among the people and exuding a confidence that perhaps he did not feel at the time. There were legendary stories about him plunging into near-riotous crowds and diffusing their anger, or traveling to army garrisons thought to be at the point of mutiny and winning the support of the troops by dint of his personality. And there was no doubt that his mood influenced the people around him, his family and his countrymen. I had seen with my own eyes the way people smiled when he smiled, laughed when he laughed, tensed when he appeared tense. Still, it had not occurred to me that people would be looking at me in more or less the same way. From the moment Hussein and I first met, I had resisted speaking to anyone about him or our life together. From the beginning, I instinctively tried to maintain a zone of privacy in our lives and believed strongly that it was a fundamental right of someone in his position. What I did not realize was that nobody else around him thought that way. They seemed to consider the king and his family public property. That fascination with personalities is, of course, universal, but I did not want to contribute to it, especially in Jordan. In such a small country, about the size of Indiana, with a population in the 1980s of more than 3 million. Every tidbit of information about the royal family, especially the king, would inevitably be embroidered or distorted and passed around with great authority. Some people were capable of looking you in the eye while saying with absolute certitude that they had witnessed an event that later would prove to have occurred when they were not even in the country. On the other hand, there was a negative aspect to trying to maintain privacy. I learned early on that, faced with discretion, some people would speculate even more. In the absence of information, they would simply make things up to give the all-important impression of having insider access and influence. I had to learn to strike an effective balance between my natural inclination to privacy and the practical value of sharing enough of our lives with others so they could understand what we were trying to accomplish. I still resisted talking to the press. Not only did I feel that my marriage should not be public fodder, but in light of the critical state of affairs in the region, I wanted to shift the dialogue in a more substantive direction. I certainly did not want to focus on personal matters, which seemed to be the primary attraction for most of the media. Despite these intentions, I did not get off to a good start. The Royal Court press secretary was urging me to give an interview to People magazine, but I was not convinced that it was the appropriate publication for my first interview. "I do not think this is the right way to go," I told him, but he persisted. I assumed that because the press was his job, he must know what he was talking about. I was appalled when the article appeared under the headline, "A Blue-Jeaned American in Jordan Says of Her King, 'I'd Be Delighted to Have His Child.'" As my interviewer was leaving the palace, I had responded, "Insha'Allah, if God wills," to a casual question about whether the king and I wanted to have children. But to see that offhand remark become the headline was mortifying. Our press secretary, who became a very good friend and later went on to serve as a distinguished ambassador abroad, was perplexed by my reaction to the article. He did not understand at all why I was so upset. After other similar incidents, I decided to follow my own instincts. As I became increasingly active in my work, I began to realize that everything I did publicly would be covered by our local media in full. I began to pick and choose what to emphasize, planning my schedule to achieve a balance between my more traditional ceremonial roles and my desire to focus on significant development initiatives, cultural, social, and environmental. I was not quite sure at the beginning, however, where I wanted to concentrate my efforts. I knew I would need a place to bring people together for meetings, and a small staff to help me follow up on requests for help and to develop new programs. Hussein encouraged me to establish an office in El Ma'wa, just up the hill from the royal court offices, since it held such sentimental value for him as his late grandfather's peaceful haven, and now for us since our engagement. It was the first such office for someone in my position, and many in the royal court were not used to the concept of a queen who would function relatively independently from the patriarchal royal court offices, which were focused exclusively on the king. It was interesting to me that many found it impossible to imagine that I could set out my own priorities, establish projects, and speak publicly on my own initiative. This reflected, I believe, lingering skepticism about women and their professional capabilities that surprised me, considering all the impressive and clearly competent women I had met in Jordan. I would never act independently on issues of political consequence, of course, or interfere with the running of the royal court, but I was looking to fill gaps in development programs and promote international understanding at this turbulent point in Middle East history. While the royal court was responsible for media coverage, my office functioned relatively independently in every other area. I ran bold new ideas past my husband, and by trying to promote a broader, more open and liberal agenda, raised issues that might not come to him otherwise. I saw my role as helping to alleviate and complement the burden of responsibility he carried. I did not ask for help or support. I just got on with it, with the help of a growing circle of friends and colleagues. I moved in and adapted Al Ma'wa's living quarters to function as office space. From the beginning, it was a special place for me, a space of my own. I wanted the office and the projects that would emanate from it to represent the best of Jordan and reflect the country's rich diversity. And I knew it was important to me to have people working in the office who represented different groups and communities in the country. Muslim and Christian, men and women from the East Bank and the West Bank, and from Circassian, liberal, and conservative backgrounds. My memories of those personally challenging times are inextricable from my memories of the political dramas we were engaged in. In the summer of 1978, we visited Iran. It was a special journey for me. I had not returned since I had lived and worked there in 1976. The revolution that would transform the country into an Islamic republic and send the Shah into exile was only a few months away. When my husband and I stayed with the royal family at their lovely Caspian retreat, there were few signs of the gathering storm. Savak, the secret police, and the Iranian military were keeping the rising revolutionary movement in check, and on the surface Iran appeared relatively calm. From people close to the Shah there were murmurings of concern to my husband and others in our entourage about popular restiveness, but there was little sense of the seismic events that would soon shake the country. I remember trying to fill in some of the picture that my husband was getting. I had a somewhat different perspective about what was going on inside Iran than he did, since his understanding of the situation was coming from his contacts with the Shah and his family, and from official military and intelligence sources. Even 2 years earlier, when I had worked in Tehran, I had become aware of a disturbing degree of polarization and fragmentation within Iranian society. During this visit, Empress Farah seemed much more vivacious and energetic than her husband, who was either weakened by the devastating cancer that would remain a secret for a while longer, or simply very shy. He spent long periods resting and playing backgammon with his doctor, while his family and friends swam, water-skied, windsurfed, and practiced a very impressive Saturday Night Fever dance routine at night. We spent a few days at the family compound in what was essentially a wonderfully relaxing extension of our honeymoon. The imperial couple pampered us with such thoughtful hospitality that at times our cares almost seemed to vanish. The family had a tennis coach, and I asked Hussein to play tennis, something I had loved since childhood, and he gamely agreed to try, and continued over most of the years of our marriage. In fact, during this visit, our only moments of anxiety were recreational, not political. One of the activities planned for us by the imperial family entailed flying by helicopter over the Caspian Sea, where we were encouraged to jump out of the helicopter into unbelievably high swells. Having grown up on the Pacific Ocean, I had never feared surf when in sight of shore, but bobbing around on those Caspian waves was close to terrifying. They were so enormous that from the troughs we lost sight of land. Our only occasional point of reference was the Navy vessel nearby, waiting to pick us up. By far the most anxious moment for me occurred when the Shah's sister, Princess Fatima, invited Hussein to join her as she piloted a helicopter around the area. She was the widow of a commander of the Iranian Air Force, and was undoubtedly an experienced pilot, but our entourage had the impression that her approach to flying was far more casual and carefree than the by-the-book approach that His Majesty always insisted upon in Jordan. One day she persuaded Hussein to accompany her on a helicopter flight over the compound. We listened to the helicopter buzzing overhead for what seemed like hours, worrying that we would never see him again, praying to God to land him safely. After we returned to Jordan, we kept close track of the deteriorating situation in Iran. We had telex machines in Hashimiya and in Aqaba, and I remember reviewing long scrolls of telex news every day. I relished that instant access to news about the region and the world. In those years before the fax machine and CNN, those curled pieces of paper were a critical part of our life, and throughout my early years of marriage would become part of my nightly ritual as I went through the news briefs, picking out news items I thought might be interesting to Hussein. But the news from Iran in the fall of 1978 was increasingly worrying. Princess Wijdan, Hussein's first cousin, returned from a visit to Iran a few months after ours, and told me that, unknown to her, 14 people had been killed in an attack on the palace, while she and other members of an official delegation from Jordan were inside, being entertained by folk dancers. The delegation, which included Crown Prince Hassan and Prince Arad and his wife, Princess Majida, had not learned about the attack or the killings until they were on a plane the next day, flying back to Jordan. September 1978, the end of Ramadan, the Muslim holy month of fasting, marked the beginning of massive street demonstrations in Tehran. Fueled by taped sermons of Ayatollah Khomeini, sent in from his exile in Iraq, the demonstrators called for the expulsion of the United States from Iran and a return to religious orthodoxy. The government responded by declaring martial law, and shortly afterward, in what became known as Black Friday, the Shah's security forces opened fire on a demonstration in Tehran, killing more than 100 people and injuring hundreds more. My husband was anguished by the bloodshed in Iran and furious at the political manipulation of the situation by Ayatollah Khomeini, who in October 1978 left Iraq for France, where he continued to broadcast into Iran. Hussein could not understand, nor could many in the Middle East, why the French would tolerate such open, hostile political activities on their own soil directed at another country. It prompted considerable suspicion. Why were the French indulging Khomeini? Reports later suggested that commercial or political gains were among the possible motives. If so, it may have worked, but at a terrible cost to the entire region. My husband and I would make one last trip to Iran at the end of 1978, just weeks before the Shah and the Shabanus' final departure on January 16, 1979. The four of us dined alone. It was a depressing evening. The Shah barely spoke, and Empress Farah was bravely trying to hold it together. Hussein was convinced that the Shah still had an opportunity to head off the political catastrophe that loomed, and urged him to go directly to the people, as Hussein had done so successfully in the past in Jordan. Talk to the people, talk to the religious scholars, talk to the army, and establish a national dialogue to diffuse the tension. But the Shah would not or could not do it. At the same time, our delegation was dining with the Iranian ambassador to Jordan, who became quite agitated during a discussion and said, "His Imperial Majesty has asked me to go to Qom to meet with the chief mullah to try to calm the situation. Please help me. I have never spoken to any of these religious people before. What should I do?" The ambassador then proposed that perhaps King Hussein could visit several key mullahs with the Shah and together see what could be done. "I am sure His Majesty would be very pleased to do so," my husband's cousin, Prince Raad, had told him. It was not a preposterous thought. The Iranians were Shiite Muslims, and as such had a special respect for King Hussein because he was a direct descendant of Ali, the Prophet's son-in-law, whom the Shiites venerated as the Prophet's rightful heir. When Abu Shakr and Prince Raad came to us later in the evening to relay the ambassador's request, Hussein immediately agreed. In spite of the late hour, my husband requested a meeting with the Shah to try to persuade him to go to Qom with him for a last-ditch effort to mediate with the scholars. But the meeting never took place. If anyone could have influenced the Shah, it was Hussein. Some years earlier, while they were having dinner at the same family compound on the Caspian Sea we had visited in 1978, he had talked the Shah out of precipitating a war. The British had been planning their withdrawal from various countries in the Gulf at the time, when suddenly, out of the blue, the Shah announced his intentions to occupy Bahrain as soon as the British left. "Bahrain is part of Iran, and we are not going to let it go," he had said to King Hussein. A long argument ensued. "You cannot do that," my husband finally told the Shah. "Bahrain is an independent Arab country, and though some of the population is Shiite, they are all Arabs, and the Arab world will not let you do that." "Oh, screw the Arabs," my husband recalled the Shah saying, to which my husband replied, "But I'm an Arab." "Oh, no, no, I do not mean you," the Shah said. "You're a Jordanian." My husband loved to recount this exchange with the Shah to family and close friends, finding the Shah's distinction between the king as an Arab and a Jordanian very amusing. But in fact, the discussion had a great impact, and Bahrain maintained its independence. Sadly, although my husband had helped to save Bahrain from occupation by the Shah, he could not save the Shah from the tragedy of his own country. Chapter 8. Pomp and Circumstance. It was often impossible to reconcile people's fantasies of what a king and queen should be with the everyday reality of our life and work. One experience I always remember with great amusement, not least because it is repeated frequently to this day, occurred upon our arrival to Gymnich Castle, the official German state guest residence outside of Bonn, Germany, on our first state visit in November 1978. Upon exiting the helicopter that had ferried President Walter Scheel, his wife, Mildred, and us from the official arrival ceremony at the airport to what would be our residence for the next several days, we were met by the wife of the castle's owner and their small son, to whom she introduced us as the King and Queen. He was adorably polite, but looked up at me with abject disappointment. "But where is her crown?" he asked his mother, who translated his plaintive words. I would encounter that same question and disappointment forevermore. Children, and many adults, crave that fairy-tale presence from royalty. Many thought a queen should be a glamorous figure on a pedestal, perhaps engaged from a distance in charity work. I had no intention of being just a figurehead and spending my time simply opening bazaars and expositions, which a member of the royal court had suggested should be my role. On the contrary, I hoped to contribute to tackling and solving real problems, much as I would have as an urban planner or a journalist. Not uncommonly for someone in my situation, I received enough different opinions about what my role should be, about how I should present myself, about everything that would be or should be expected of me, that I could easily have been 10 different people and never satisfied anyone. I had to come to terms with the fact that for many people a queen's persona began with how she looked and dressed. I felt particularly awkward about this, but I understood the importance of ceremony and of making a good public impression. Looking back on those first years, I find it laughable how much I had to learn. When our first state visit to Germany was scheduled 4 months after the wedding, to be followed in December with visits to France, Italy, and the United Kingdom, I had to quickly confront the issue of clothing. My blue jeans and blazer would not do. The wife of the controller of Hashimiya suggested to my husband that she contact the fashion designer Valentino in Italy to inquire if they might quickly provide us with some outfits for these visits. Valentino, who had designed clothes for Queen Alia and at least one other member of the family, sent his assistant to Jordan with what remained of the design models of their fall-winter collection. I was still very thin, so size was no problem, which was fortunate, as there was no time to have anything made. It was a relief to know I had something suitable, and, needless to say, absolutely beautiful to wear. I looked upon these outfits as work clothes that gave me the freedom to concentrate on the job of representing Jordan in ways that could directly benefit the country. I also considered the pieces of jewelry I had received as wedding presents, and the lovely diamond tiara from my husband, to be working adornments as well. I did not have any jewelry of my own, save for the sentimental odd silver bracelet or ring, but during the first months of our marriage, my husband returned several times from visits to countries in the region and surprised me with belated wedding gifts of exquisite jewelry from various Arab rulers. As much as I admired these magnificent gifts, I never felt completely comfortable wearing them. Jordan was a poor country, and it seemed inappropriate for me to wear such jewelry at home, even if others did on occasion. It was more fitting for formal occasions abroad, but even that discomforted me. My husband, however, had a typically Arab appreciation for brilliant color and ornate design, so he encouraged me to wear an exquisite emerald necklace, a wedding gift from King Khaled of Saudi Arabia, to the official banquet on our state visit to Germany. Instead of carrying it off with élan, I spent the entire evening feeling like a Christmas tree and self-consciously attempted to conceal the necklace under the chiffon shawl of my dress. Many other guests that evening were simply dressed, and I did not want the contrast between their attire and mine to create any distance between us. A queen may be expected to present a glittering image, but it was neither my nature nor what I considered useful as a representative of Jordan. Over the years I tried to achieve a balance between an understated style and the need to look regal, but invariably erred, in my view, by going to one extreme or the other. Our state visit to Bonn proceeded smoothly, but I was looking forward to the weekend retreat at the southern Germany resort of Berchtesgaden that our hosts had planned for us at the end of our state visit. We would be celebrating my husband's birthday high up in the mountains. We were treated to rare November skiing on the Zugspitze peak, high above the town of Garmisch-Partenkirchen. Our first venture on skis together was absolutely comical. My husband had skied only perhaps one other time in his life, and was extremely cautious in following his instructor's lead. While I had not had occasion to ski for some years, I had enjoyed the sport since the age of 13 and expected to pick up somewhere close to where I had left off. This had me skiing quite hard and fast, falling often, picking myself up, and carrying on again. My husband, who never fell, looked at me cartwheeling down the slope as if I were quite mad. I, in turn, looked at him methodically making his way down, surrounded by photographers, his extensive German security detail, and our intrepid royal guards, for whom skiing did not exactly come naturally, and thought it was all quite comical. This first ski outing together became a favorite family story as we laughingly recounted the madcap scene and recalled what a huge relief it was to unwind after the intense formality and self-consciousness of the state visit. There was more formality to come, and again I found that I could not always manage it the way I would have preferred. During our state visit to France, my mother-in-law, Queen Zane, insisted that I see her hairdresser, the famous Alexandre, who came to the Marigny State Guest Palace to prepare me for our state banquet at Versailles. Alexandre, who was extremely gallant and flattering, gave me a quick look and began work on an elaborate updo. By the time he was finished, my hair looked like it was wearing me. He then sprayed it with so much lac, as hairspray is so appropriately called in France, that my hair became a veritable fortress, impenetrable to my efforts to tone it down after he left. I was practically in tears as we prepared to leave for the state banquet. I felt ridiculous. Today, Marge Simpson might be the best example of my appearance. My husband sweetly assured me I looked perfectly splendid and that we should leave for the dinner. It is possible my husband really liked my hair. Certainly he relished it when I represented Jordan by bringing a touch of fairy tale to the all-too-serious affairs of state. I showed him two evening dresses on our first state visit to the United States, one a simple one I planned to wear, and the other a beaded jacket over a long skirt. He immediately chose the beaded jacket, which proved quite a contrast with Mrs. Carter's very simple dress. Whenever I gave him a choice, he would always choose the more elaborate option. Eventually, I would incline towards simpler and often ethnic Jordanian dresses that suited both our personal styles. It has always puzzled me that a woman in the public eye is judged first for her appearance, then for her achievements. Granted, the fashion business is a huge industry worldwide, and the clothes a woman in a high-profile position chooses to wear can not only ensure success for an individual designer, but promote the fashion industry of an entire country. Princess Diana, for example, did wonders for British designers, and therefore for the economy of Britain. This is why French first ladies wear French designs, and American first ladies wear American designs. It is good for business. Had there been a Jordanian designer I could have showcased, I would have. But at the time, there were not any. Also, at the beginning, I did not fully understand the financial value of celebrity to designers. In Rome, during our official visit to Italy, I decided to pass by Valentino and thank him for helping me out with my German visit on such short notice. I left the motorcade behind and strolled as unobtrusively as possible to his office near the Spanish steps. I was horrified when I turned the corner to find a throng of photographers and reporters clearly waiting for me. Though I began to appreciate that publicizing celebrity clients was one way designers build and sustain their reputations, I was deeply uncomfortable being used as a form of promotion. It would be a problem for me for years, because minimal contact with some designers, or even none at all, was too often exaggerated, creating the distorted impression that I was a major consumer of outrageously expensive fashion. I would have 5 pregnancies over the next 6 years, which would complicate this aspect of my life even more. Eventually, I would make use of U.S. mail-order catalogs to cover basic necessities economically and expeditiously. My lack of interest in fashion produced one very amusing result at the beginning of our marriage. The first state visits I made with my husband to Europe garnered a lot of press coverage, with the emphasis, of course, on my appearance. That same year, Barbara Walters came to Jordan to film us for a television special. During one interview, we took Barbara to the royal stables with Abir, Haya, and Ali to show her and her audience the beautiful Arab horses that were the pride and joy of my husband and his family. I wore jeans and a suede jacket to the stables, which seemed appropriate to me, but evidently not to everyone. At the end of the year, Earl Blackwell chose me for his infamous worst-dressed list, charging that the jeans and the suede jacket I had worn in the Barbara Walters interview made me look like a centerfold for Popular Mechanics. With an irony I relished, I was also listed simultaneously on the International Best Coiffed and International Best Dressed lists. In that first year of marriage, issues of public image were of some import, because I was just learning my way. But they were nothing compared to our real preoccupations, especially the search for peace in the Middle East. At that time, there was no greater challenge to my husband's lifelong dream of bringing stability to the region than what was transpiring at Camp David, the U.S. presidential retreat outside of Washington, D.C. The 12-day meeting between Sadat, Begin, and Carter, and their respective delegations, took place in September, while we were on a brief working visit to London. When our ambassador, Ibrahim Izzeddin, told Hussein that he had received a call from Sadat's secretary in Camp David, setting up a time for Sadat to talk to him, my husband was cautiously optimistic. The call was set for early morning, but it did not come. We waited all day in considerable suspense until Sadat finally called late that night to inform Hussein that he was planning to leave Camp David because, he said, he had not been able to reach an agreement with Begin. The king came away from the conversation relieved that Sadat was adhering to his position not to make a separate peace with Israel at the expense of the Palestinians. The two leaders arranged to meet in Morocco in a few days' time. En route to the Morocco meeting, we traveled to Mallorca to visit King Juan Carlos and Queen Sofia of Spain at their beautiful summer house overlooking the Mediterranean. I had just met Queen Sofia's brother, King Constantine of Greece, and his wife, Queen Anne Marie, daughter of Danish King Frederick IX and Queen Ingrid, longtime friends of Hussein's in London. They had been forced into exile after a military coup in 1967, yet remained actively engaged with the Greek community and in the promotion of Greek culture and education. They had settled into a modest house in Hampstead, where they had successfully started a new life. I liked them both enormously, and we would see them whenever possible on our visits to London, and frequently invite them and their family to Jordan. In Mallorca, I was intrigued by Queen Sofia's modern and natural approach to royal traditions. Though the queen and her family belonged to one of the oldest royal houses in Europe, her full name is Sofia de Grecia y Hanover, and she is related to the Tsars of Russia, the German emperors, and Great Britain's Queen Victoria, she described how she and the king, Juan Carlos de Borbón y Borbón, were attempting to simplify the private and the public and ceremonial aspects of their life. The couple often drove their own car, mingled informally with their citizens, and moved freely about the country. They had restricted the use of tiaras, elaborate jewelry, and state regalia to exchanges with other reigning monarchs, rather than all official occasions. We were impressed with the way they had chosen to live in Madrid, instead of residing in the huge, magnificent museum palace, the Prado. The Spanish royal family lived in the Palacio de la Zarzuela, a relatively modest home they had built in a wooded area on the outskirts of Madrid. We loved the long drive to the house, which wound through a wildlife reserve teeming with deer. Hussein often compared their cozy, unpretentious home to the marble-lined, hotel-like space of Hashemiyah and wished that we could live that way as well. Hussein and Juan Carlos were great friends. My husband had supported and counseled the king through a decade of dramatic change in Spain, from the restoration of the monarchy in 1969 by the country's longtime dictator, General Francisco Franco, to the establishment of a constitutional monarchy in 1978, 3 years after the death of Franco. It was King Juan Carlos, together with Franco's holdover government, who reintroduced democracy to Spain, and, in 1977, held the first democratic elections in the country in 41 years. The newly elected Spanish Parliament then adopted a new constitution and designated the reigning monarch as king. It was Sophie who first noted that I had made an instinctive adjustment to my new life, one that she had never had to make. Sophie is a very accomplished sailor, having been a reserve member of the Greek sailing team in the 1960 Olympic Games in Rome, in which her brother, Constantine, won a gold medal. She and I went out sailing that first summer on a hot, sunny day, in a small laser sailboat in a very private cove. As Sophie frequently recounted, several tourist boats suddenly appeared from around the bend of the coast, interrupting our private idyll, and I immediately covered myself. I had lived in a Muslim culture long enough to know that being seen in anything as revealing as a bathing suit in public would be an affront to more conservative Muslims. Sophie said she was struck by how instinctively conscious I was of maintaining a balance between modesty and naturalness. Our visit to Spain came to an abrupt end. We awoke one morning, and, as usual, turned on our shortwave radio to listen to the BBC World Service. To our dismay, we heard the terse announcement that Anwar Sadat had reached an agreement with Menachem Begin at Camp David. There was no mention of self-determination for the Palestinians. It seemed that our nightmare scenario had arrived. King Hussein was in a state of shock, especially in light of the reassurances he had received from Sadat a few days earlier. He immediately cancelled our trip to Morocco and called our Spanish hosts to inform them that we would have to depart immediately for Jordan. However, as details of the agreement emerged, it would become clear that the damage of Camp David would not be easily contained. Indeed, the fallout would dramatically influence the 21 years of our married life and my husband's quest for peace. Chapter 9. One Crisis After Another. My husband rarely lost his temper. When he was vexed, his eyes would darken and the muscles would ripple around his jaw, two expressions that became etched on his face as he was briefed on the details emerging from Camp David. The agreement, signed at the White House on September 17, 1978, was a disaster for the Palestinians and a disaster for Jordan. Anwar Sadat, under pressure from Jimmy Carter and Menachem Begin, had accepted an accord that was crucially flawed in what it failed to include. There was no specific commitment from Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories to pre-1967 borders. The formula of land for peace embodied in UN Resolution 242. Menachem Begin refused to even call the occupied Palestinian territories the West Bank. Instead, he would insist on, and Jimmy Carter would honor, a definition of the Palestinian West Bank as Judea and Samaria. And in language inflammatory to the Arab world, he also referred to it as liberated territory. There was no mention of Arab or Muslim rights over occupied Arab East Jerusalem. In fact, Jerusalem was not mentioned at all. Nor did the agreement contain a timetable for Israel to dismantle the Jewish settlements that were being steadily and illegally established on the occupied West Bank. In what was probably the most destructive result of Camp David, the language shifted from Palestinian independence to Palestinian autonomy. With one stroke of the pen, the agreement at Camp David made autonomy the most that Palestinians could hope to achieve, and only with the consent of the Israelis over a 5-year period. An independent Palestinian state was out of the question. My husband's sense of betrayal was compounded by the accord's many references to the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan, without him having been consulted at all. His face tensed furiously as he read what the Americans and the Egyptians expected of him. Jordan, not the PLO, should represent the Palestinians in further negotiations. Jordan, along with Egypt and Israel, would define the terms of autonomy for the Palestinians in the occupied territories. The provisions of the accord between Israel and Egypt would form the principles for a peace treaty between Israel and Jordan. The situation was rife with bitter ironies, This peace accord was already acting as a destructive force. The Camp David agreement had driven a wedge between the United States and Jordan, and while Sadat was being lionized as a great visionary in America, the leaders of the Arab countries were gathering for a summit in Baghdad to condemn him. The summit was a momentous occasion for King Hussein, both personally and politically. He had not been to Iraq since his cousin, King Faisal, and other members of the Iraqi royal family were murdered in 1958 during a coup d'état. The cousins had been very close, attending Harrow and Sandhurst together, and spending vacations together. They had even been crowned on the same day. My husband told me how he personally had warned the commander of the Iraqi military about the threat of a coup, and had been condescendingly ignored. Less than a week after his warning, anti-monarchists seized the palace. Accounts differ on what had happened, but according to one eyewitness report, relayed to a member of the Jordanian royal family, King Faisal was walking down the stairs of the palace with his family, having been promised safe passage from the country, when the insurgents opened fire. King Faisal's grandmother had a Quran in her hand and called out, "Please spare Faisal, swear by the Quran." But all of them, except for one aunt, were machine-gunned to death. My husband never forgave himself for not being more forceful in his efforts to warn Iraqi officials of the danger. In November 1978, King Hussein joined 20 other countries in the 22-member Arab League for the Baghdad summit. Only Egypt stayed behind. The Arab League decided to send a delegation to Cairo to make one last attempt to dissuade Sadat from pursuing a separate peace with Israel, but the Egyptian president refused to see them. Instead, Sadat fueled the flames of dissent by publicly dismissing the leaders at the summit as cowards and dwarfs, and announcing that he had no intention of listening to the hissing of snakes. During the 6 months it took for the Carter administration to negotiate the details of the final Egyptian-Israeli agreement, the Americans put extraordinary pressure on my husband to endorse the Camp David Accords. Listening to my husband discuss strategies and responses with his advisers was an invaluable exposure to realpolitik. I had seen some evidence of American pressure during my time in Iran and in the Arab world, but to have it brought home to me, literally, was sobering. March 26, 1979, the day the final peace accords between Egypt and Israel were signed by Begin, Sadat, and Carter in Washington, D.C., was a black day in Jordan. I remember Leila, whose husband was now prime minister, glaring at the ceremony on television and saying over and over again to Sadat, "Don't sign, don't sign it, please, God, break the pen." But of course he did sign, and the inevitable repercussions followed. The region was already in turmoil. The Shah had been forced out of Iran just 2 months earlier, and the Ayatollah Khomeini had returned to a tumultuous welcome. The signing of the Camp David Accords created yet another incendiary element in an already volatile situation. For my husband, it represented a terrible setback. He was deeply disappointed by Sadat's opportunism, the short-sightedness of the United States, and the scuttling of the International Peace Conference that he felt promised the best chance for achieving a comprehensive Middle East peace. Camp David set us on a roller coaster ride from which the region, and we as Jordanians, have still not fully recovered. It was a heightened joy for both of us in this dark period to discover that I was pregnant. We had never spoken about having children, nor had we spoken about not having children. Hussein already had 8, 3 of whom were living with us, but he had sent a startling signal when I was working on plans for a new home. "Be sure to put in 6 bedrooms for the children," he told me. "What?" I said. "Certainly not anticipating 3 more on top of those we already had." When we received news one day from my doctor that I was expecting, Hussein was, in his own words, "over the moon." We tried to keep the news quiet until the 3rd month, when we told the children, who were thrilled with the prospect of a new brother or sister. I felt doubly blessed when my husband told me he would soon be making his Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca and visiting Medina in Saudi Arabia. In years past, he had gone on the lesser pilgrimage, or Umrah, usually on the 27th day of the month of Ramadan, the holiest night of the year. He had never made the full Hajj, however, which spans 5 days of the last month of the Islamic Hijri year, which is based on the lunar calendar and therefore is approximately 11 days shorter than the Gregorian calendar used in the West. The faithful gather in the plain of Arafat and pray all day for forgiveness in particular. Every able Muslim is obligated to make the Hajj to Mecca once in his or her life. But my husband had never felt the time was right for him. I felt extraordinarily blessed that he felt the moment was right so soon after we married. During the Hajj, my husband wore 2 seamless plain white cloths around the waist and over the shoulder, as do male pilgrims, to reinforce the fundamental equality and humility of every man before God. Together he and the multitudes at Mecca would face the Kaaba, the sacred simple stone structure in the middle of the vast white marble courtyard of the Holy Mosque, known as the El Haram El Sharif. Men and women pray together in the Haram, the only mosque, except for the Prophet's Mosque in Medina, where they are not segregated in prayer. Here my husband's ancestor, Abraham, rebuilt the first house of worship to God 3,000 years ago. And here, some 2 millennia later, the Prophet Muhammad, Abraham's spiritual and blood heir, smashed the pagan idols of those who had forsaken God. Hussein's reasons for going to Mecca were always purely spiritual, and he would try to be inconspicuous, but word would get out nonetheless that he was there. Because of his lineage, it was not unusual for pilgrims from all over the world to applaud when he entered, saluting him with the words, "Ahlan bi Sabt al-Rasul," welcome to the Prophet's grandson. When he returned from the Hajj, I was delighted to see him so peaceful, so restored. He tried to share the extraordinary impact of his spiritual journey with me, but it would be 20 years before I would fully appreciate its transforming power, when I made my own Umrah pilgrimage to Mecca. Indeed, his rejuvenated spirit helped us through the losses we were about to face. I was passing through London in the early spring of 1979 when my husband called to sadly inform me that his maternal uncle, Sharif Nasser bin Jamil, had suddenly died of a heart attack. His unexpected death was a shock for us all. Sharif Nasser had been at my husband's side from the beginning of his reign. He had been commander-in-chief of the armed forces in the early 1970s and had saved my husband's life on several occasions. They had also been extraordinarily close. Sharif Nasser had been one of the first family members to wholeheartedly congratulate us on our engagement, and he had given us a beautiful piece of land where we hoped some day to build our home. His wife, Hind, a close friend and talented artist, was, like me, expecting a child at the time. We moved from one trauma to the next. Hussein was preparing to go to Baghdad for what would be a final censure of Egypt for its position on Camp David. The day after his call, before returning to Amman, I had traveled to Hampstead to have lunch with our friends, King Constantine and Queen Anne Marie of Greece, and Anne Marie's mother, Queen Ingrid of Denmark. 5 months into my pregnancy, I suddenly felt terribly weak. I was introduced to Queen Ingrid as soon as I entered the drawing room, but I had to excuse myself right away. Anne Marie followed me out of the room in concern, as I explained that I was not feeling well. She did not tell me what she feared, but took me to her room to lie down. As I began to hemorrhage, she went quietly to call her own doctor, George Pinker, the obstetrician of the British royal family. He was away fishing in Scotland, but his assistant agreed to come out as quickly as possible. Because Constantine and Anne-Marie lived a distance from the center of London, it took ages for the doctor to arrive, and by then the sad realization of what was happening to me began to register. While we waited for the doctor, Constantine came into the room to tell me he was calling my husband. I begged him not to. He is on his way to Baghdad. This is a critical moment for him. He has all he can handle. We argued, and then he went off and called my husband anyway. I almost broke down when I heard Hussein's voice, but I had pledged to myself from the beginning not to add to my husband's burdens. "Shall I come?" he said. "No, absolutely not," I told him. "Stay there and do what you have to do. I will be fine." I was not fine, of course. My sense of loss was intensified by feelings of acute failure and guilt. I was far enough along in the pregnancy to have felt the baby moving, and had formed a real connection to the life inside me. I felt desperate to get to the hospital, and under proper care, but ambulances were on semi-strike in England, and operating on a go-slow order, so it would take longer than normal for the ambulance to be dispatched to the house in Hampstead. Then, with no siren, not even flashing lights, if I remember correctly, the ambulance crawled at a snail's pace to the hospital. The entire way the doctor kept telling me to hold on, hold on, as I struggled with the excruciating pain. Upon arriving at the hospital, everything happened so quickly that I only remember lying in the hospital bed when it was all over. The phone was ringing. When the operator said, "It's Mr. Brown for Mrs. Brown," I thought she had called the wrong room, not knowing that I had been registered under the name of Brown for security. I would soon become used to the name. Forever after, Hussein and I became the Browns when we wanted a measure of privacy. I learned in the hospital, however, that complete privacy would never be possible. Almost immediately, news of my miscarriage appeared in the London tabloids. I felt truly violated that this most personal of moments, and the tremendous loss we were feeling, was being used as fodder for public consumption. My sister must have heard the despair in my voice when she called me at the hospital. She talked to me for a long time, and in our grief we bonded together as adults. I will always be grateful to Alexa for taking leave of her work at a Washington law firm to fly to London to be with me. My husband arrived in London as soon as he was able after the Baghdad summit, and knowing of my love for skiing, surprised me with plans to visit the tiny ski town of Zurs in the Austrian Alps for a few days. The last time I had skied there had been as a young teenager with my family. Jordan's consul general for Austria had kindly made all the arrangements. But my husband and I were never alone. We spent our entire few days there in the company of the consul general and his wife, as well as our entourage and the people they had met in the hotel. Instead of being able to talk to my husband about our loss and perhaps comfort each other, we were constantly surrounded by people and, of course, had to put on a valiant face for everyone. I finally broke down on our last night in the Arlberg. We had been taken by sleigh to a small village above the nearby village of Lech to a typical mountain hut for dinner, where young children serenaded us. In the tightly packed, overheated space, I became very emotional. I managed to control myself in the public situation, but on the way home, I suddenly realized that not once had my husband asked me about the miscarriage. Not once had we talked about it. Though I knew that by putting on a brave face I had sent an inaccurate message about my well-being, I also knew that my show of strength and resilience had simply been accepted at face value. "We can't just pretend this never happened," I said to myself. I became quite angry with Hussein, and perhaps a little angry with myself for concealing my feelings. I told him how difficult our time in Austria had been for me, which evoked an instructive response. "Well, this trip has been difficult for me, too," he said. "The last time I was in the Alps in a sleigh was in St. Moritz with the Shah and Shabanu of Iran, and now they have been forced out of their country." I looked at him, dumbfounded by this seeming non sequitur, but I was discovering a pattern of behavior that would hold throughout our marriage. His response to any personal concern I expressed would be to counter with some greater problem that he was suffering from, in order to put my problem into perspective. I also learned that this man, who had the biggest heart in the world, could not talk about things that were personally painful to him, precisely because he felt that pain so deeply. He just could not handle it. We were blessed with another pregnancy 6 months later. Though many assumed I would have the baby abroad, or at least bring in a Western doctor, I had full confidence in our Jordanian obstetrician, Dr. Arif Bataine. He was the royal family's obstetrician, and a colleague of Queen Anne Marie's English doctor, George Pinker, who had looked in on me after my miscarriage and would consult on the pregnancy. They decided I should not travel outside the country for the first several months, which was a relief. I had more than enough work to do at home. I had already become involved in a variety of national issues. The United Nations had designated 1979 as the International Year of the Child, and I was appointed chair of Jordan's National Committee for the Child. I invited government ministers and representatives of international and non-governmental organizations, NGOs, working with Jordanian children, to Hashemiyah Palace, where we met to assess the general state of Jordan's children and to begin to identify short- and long-term priorities and strategies. Child welfare and development was an urgent national priority because our population was so young. More than half of all Jordanians were under 16, and one-fifth were under 5 years old. Our birth rate was exceptionally high, more than twice the average in the developing world, in part because of the dramatic influx of refugees. This population increase put immense pressure on all our services, particularly education and health. There was severe overcrowding in many schools and very high student-teacher ratios. Most schools ran daily double shifts. We had an appalling shortage of children's books and very few facilities and parks, especially for children in poor neighborhoods. Austria's Prime Minister, Bruno Kreisky, wrote to me in the early 1980s recommending SOS Kinderdorf International, a network of children's villages for orphans and abandoned children around the world, an initiative that was first developed in the chaotic aftermath of World War II, when so many children were left homeless and without families. After meeting with Hermann Gmeiner, its founder, we began a long and rewarding partnership. Every SOS children's village offers a permanent family-style home to children who have lost their parents or can no longer live with them. 4 to 10 boys and girls of different ages live together with their SOS mother in a family house, and 8 to 15 SOS children's village families form a village community. My husband and I often visited the Amman and Aqaba villages, especially on the occasions of our Eid holidays, when families traditionally gather to celebrate the breaking of the fast. Jafar Tukan, a talented local architect and friend, contributed a unique and beautiful design for our first SOS village near Amman, which Hussein and I opened in 1987. A charming, traditional enclave of stone houses connected by courtyards and flowing gardens. The village design represented our first attempt together to develop a culturally and environmentally sensitive architectural model for Jordan. Jafar and I worked together, a few years later, on another pioneering design for an SOS village in Aqaba that won the Aga Khan Award in 2001, and finally a third in Irbid, in the north of Jordan, that opened in 1999. I was thrilled in 2002 when SOS Kinderdorf was recognized for its unique contribution to our world's children and was awarded the prestigious Conrad N. Hilton Humanitarian Prize. In the health sector, we began by inaugurating a national immunization campaign, which I launched with the Minister of Health in several rural areas, administering some oral vaccines myself to promote awareness of the importance of the campaign. In 1980, we joined UNICEF's Child Survival and Development Revolution, which led to a reduction in infant and maternal mortality rates through the use of low-cost interventions such as growth monitoring, oral rehydration, breastfeeding, and immunization. By the end of the 1980s, Jordan had achieved human development advances that were recognized by UNICEF and other agencies worldwide as exemplary in the developing world, in areas such as nutrition, school enrollment and girls' education, and access to health services and water. We ranked among the top 45 countries in the world to achieve immunization rates above 90%. And so, with great pride, in 1990, I represented King Hussein at the United Nations World Summit for Children, joining with 71 heads of state and governments to sign the World Declaration on the Survival, Protection, and Development of Children. The next year, Jordan ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which became the most widely accepted human rights treaty ever, inspiring social change in all regions of the world. The only nations that have not signed it yet